This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Guy Madden has been called the best filmmaker you've never heard of. Visually, Madden's work is inspired by silent films and German Expressionism. His movies include Tales from the Gimli Hospital and Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary, a film adaptation of a ballet version of the Dracula story. Terry spoke with Guy Madden earlier this year about his latest movie, The Saddest Music in the World, which has just been released on DVD. It's a surrealistic comedy set during the Depression in Winnipeg, one of the coldest places in North America, which also happens to be the place where Guy Madden grew up and still makes his home. The film stars Isabella Rossellini as the owner of a beer brewery. She launches an international contest to find the saddest music in the world. Her life and the lives of all the main characters have been transformed by tragedy and grief. That may not sound very funny, but this is an odd film, inspired by Depression-era musicals, silent movies, and touches of Todd Browning's Freaks. Here's Rossellini in a scene from the film.
We at Musket Beer are proud that Winnipeg has been chosen 4 years in a row by the London Times as the world capital of sorrow in the Great Depression. In recognition of this honor, we will be hosting a worldwide contest to determine which nation's music truly deserves to be called the saddest in the world. Aspiring virtuosos of tearful melody are welcome to travel here and lay claim to the jewel-studded crown of frozen tears and $25,000 in prize money. That's right.
Guy Madden, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your movie, The Saddest Music in the World, is adapted from a screenplay that was written by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote Remains of the Day. Right. But his screenplay was set in the 80s, and yours is set in the 1930s during the Depression. I think you probably reworked a lot of the original concept. Talk about your idea for what the contest would be like to find the saddest music in the world.
Well, the original premise of such a contest was Ish's, and he saw it as a political satire, mostly about the way it's kind of sad that countries that are already suffering from the worst privations imaginable still have to pretend to be even worse off than they really are just to get some sort of international sympathy and charity, and that everyone is forced into this undignified limbo contest of exaggerating their misery to get some charity. And for me, the contest was a great backdrop for the way families and people in love manipulate each other in much the same way that countries do. And it was a great great chance for me to have an orgy of self-pity, not just among nations, but among family members. You know the way families really mess with each other's minds. And so I just found sort of a microcosm within Ish's political satire. And my obsessions are always with family melodrama anyway. So it was just a matter of putting that peanut butter on Ish's chocolate and coming up with something that pleased us both.
Let's talk about the music a little bit. There actually is a contest in the movie for the saddest music in the world, and representatives from countries around the world show up to perform their music and vie for the cash reward.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about finding performers from around the world to use in this contest? Because you have real performers from different countries.
Yeah, most of them live in my hometown of Winnipeg.
Oh, really?
I
imagined you going around the world.
That's right. That's right. On a big talent
putting
search.
Classifieds in newspapers around the world.
That's right. Going to Moscow and
exactly
Stockholm,
Scotland.
No, we just put an ad in the paper and actually dealt through the Winnipeg Folk Arts Council and just arranged for a massive audition. We just told various El Salvadorian musicians, Portuguese fado musicians, Ukrainian bandurists to show up in costume with their instruments in full plumage, and to play the two saddest songs they had in their repertoire. And we just invited them all to come up to this very tiny, crowded ballroom we rented in a hotel. They all had to ride up in an elevator, a very tiny elevator, so a big mariachi band would crowd out of the elevator while the Heather Bells, the all-female Highland bagpipe troupe, marched in. And it was great just to see the clash of colors, plaids, sombreros. It was really exciting, and I realized I kind of had half my musical problems solved right there at the audition. It was just a matter of picking my favorites from this and just getting a nice balance of colors and costumes and musics.
How did you explain yourself to them?
I kind of didn't, and that was kind of fun, just looking at the sheer puzzlement on their faces. And at one point in the auditions, I always encouraged the last group of musicians to stay on while the next one came on, and I would have them play at the same time and actually have them try to cross-pollinate or actually get down lower. I was thinking in terms of limbo, and I would tell the klezmer clarinetist to get down below the Ukrainian clarinetist and try to get down lower in pitch and lower in physicality and literally compete and cross swords with clarinets. And it was really kind of fun to watch these people literally competing for the tears of of the judges, me, my producers, musically, and it was all just sort of playing itself out the way it did in the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like a battle of the bands, except that they're all playing incredibly sad music.
Yeah, and it really was just like, I guess, just watching this self-pitying ants at a tea party just going at it and trying to top each other's stories of woe. I grew up in a family where people did that all the time, where Icelandic and all stories about our family are about tragedy and misery and, you know, plagues, blight, volcanic eruptions, etc.
Let me play the song I'd probably vote for if I were a judge in this contest for the saddest music in the world. And I'll just play an excerpt of this. This is a Mexican song, sung from the point of view of a mother who is singing to her dead baby. And as we hear the song, we'll also hear the announcers who are announcing this contest as it happens. And, of course, they're totally undercutting the tragedy with their absolutely clueless explanations of what's going on. So why don't we hear the scene?
Are giving us a sad peek into child burial customs down Mexico way.
The Mexican mama is being very firm with her dead infant. Now go away, she wails.
You are dead.
Don't sneak in at night to nurse from my breast. That milk is only for the living.
To Canadian ears, that may sound harsh.
Well, I guess dead children, like any other kind, have got to learn.
It's a short scene from Guy Maddin's new film, The Saddest Music in the World. Guy, tell me.
No, I actually have a song, songwriting credit on that song, by the way.
Oh, did you co-write it?
I cannot read music, but I wrote the lyrics. I can't speak Spanish either, but I had the singer translated, and I just had to trust the translation.
What went through your mind as you were writing this?
Well, I just...
I mean, how did you come up with this idea of the woman singing to her dead child?
Well, there's nothing sadder than that, but you know, in spite of the recent epidemic of dead child movies that have been put out there, I find it extremely difficult to even approach the magnitude, the enormity of such a feeling. So it had, the only way to present it for me was to undercut it instantly somehow, and just to let off the clear message that I wasn't going to try to reach anybody's heart at that point. It was just had to be goofy.
Guy Maddin, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview, recorded earlier this year, with filmmaker Guy Maddin. His latest movie, The Saddest Music in the World, has just been released on DVD.
Well, thinking back to the last interview that you did on Fresh Air after your ballet version of Dracula, And somehow we were talking about grief, which of course relates to this new movie, and you had mentioned that that your brother killed himself when he was 19, that he shot himself on the grave of his girlfriend.
Yeah, when I was 7, or just turning 7, I remember thinking it was quite thoughtless of him to do that just a week before my birthday. Yeah, it was, you know, obviously a horrible tragedy. It's the worst thing that could happen to parents. I was young enough that it was turned into a romance for me. The idea that he got to go to heaven with his girlfriend and that they were somehow being virtually married there, and that that our two families, the family of the dead girlfriend and my family, sort of considered each other in-laws as a way of making sense of this gesture of their sadnesses. It just seemed very romantic to me, the idea of, you know, very Wuthering Heights, you know, the idea of just giving your whole life for the love of somebody. And maybe that's what made me more receptive to romantic literature later, and I don't know, but it seems like the little garden from which I sprung was well watered with tears. It didn't. This isn't self-pity talking. It's something I just observed as a way of growing up. It didn't. Like I said, I couldn't have had a happier childhood. I loved it.
How did your brother's girlfriend die?
In a car accident. It was horrible. You know, it was horrible. But and it just ruined him. You know, it was. He hung in there for about 6 months and then couldn't take it anymore.
There's a car accident in this movie too.
Yeah, there is. Although the words "car accident" don't mean anything to me. Maybe they probably are horrible words to hear for the girl's family. But I don't know. All the trappings of that incident were as artificial as a TV show to me at that age. So I don't cringe or tweak when I hear those words.
It didn't scare you to death that your brother, in one gesture, was able to take his life away?
I don't know how to make sense of what I thought of it. I know I was given his bedroom the very night that he did it, and he had a way better bedroom than I did, and so I was, you know, I was pretty happy about that. I shared it with my other brother, who couldn't stand the sound of my night breathing. You know, it sort of haunted him a lot, and it might have. And I immediately thought I was him, and, you know, immediately started thinking about what it would be like to die or to kill myself, and, you know, in those ways that every child daydreams about, just wanting to go away when things don't go right, to remove yourself. But, it, you know, I never really seriously considered it. It was just kind of a play daydream that I like to replay all the time.
I'm thinking back to something else you said in that first interview that we did. You said that when people who were important to you died, you felt you didn't grieve at the time, and that you even had to fake tears at their funeral. And I was thinking, you know, this just seems so connected to me, to this new movie, The Saddest Music in the World, because, you know, one of the characters just is incapable of grieving, and he kind of walks through life as if it were like a bleak comedy. And another character goes through life, because her grief is so deep, she falls into amnesia. Her only way of surviving is just totally to forget.
I guess you're very astute, Terry, because I think you have picked up on some kind of autobiographical trait that I've put in the movie, maybe without even thinking about it. I know when I was in my mid-teens, my father developed a very serious heart condition, and I just lived in terror of him just dropping dead of a heart attack. And the words "heart attack" literally launched me, whenever I happened to hear them on TV or in a conversation, would launch me into a procedure of elaborate superstitions, you know, crossing my fingers, knocking on wood, backing out of a room, left foot first, and all sorts of elaborate, strange, exhausting procedures. And I think when my father finally did have a heart attack and die, that, or when he did die of some heart-related thing, that a fuse went in me, and I couldn't grieve. It was everything I'd feared and worse, because it really happened, and I just felt nothing, and I felt a bit ashamed of myself for not feeling anything. But I'm sure it's common that some people just can't feel anything. I guess it's just simply being in shock. Well, it didn't even feel like being in shock. I remember actually kind of enjoying all the company and sympathy I was getting around funeral time. it's pretty gloomy stuff we're talking about. But then I did grieve in the installment plan. For years, I was revisited by my father in regular dreams, just probably a pathological number of dreams. And so these characters, this woman who virtually is visited with amnesia when her child dies, is kind of just a version of that, I guess. It's just a matter of her being faced with something that's just unbearable, and amnesia is the only way to go. Amnesia and nymphomania, as it turns out.
That's right. She's got that, too.
That's two Band-Aids on top of a trauma.
Let me quote two things about sadness that are said in the movie. One is, what good is memory? Why make yourself sad? And the other is, sadness is just happiness turned on its ass. It's all showbiz.
Yeah, I'm just trying to make sense of what sadness is. I know I don't like being sad very much, and the weirdest things make me sad. I don't know.
Like what?
Sometimes a movie that's mediocre for some reason. I like a really bad movie or a really good movie, but a movie that just somehow, there's a certain combination of notes that mediocrity combines to form and that just about has me suicidal. For some reason, the second Matrix movie had me on suicide alert. I had to make some hotline phone calls after walking out of that theater. I don't know.
Why? Because mediocrity wastes your time, or because there's something emotional in a mediocre film? Like, what is it?
Yeah, that one, I started daydreaming a bit about my brother, something I almost never do. And I know he was a bit of a science fiction enthusiast and kind of a technical freak. He built a stereo with his bare hands when he was 15 years old, and built a radio station and was arrested for broadcasting, from a pirate station when he was a young teen. And so I just started thinking of, I started daydreaming that I was watching this movie with him for some reason. This is something I've never done before. And then the movie was so overwhelmingly filled with effects that he would never have been able to comprehend at his young age, and then but then it was so incomprehensibly boring at the same time that I remember just sort of thinking that maybe my brother would decide that he should have lived all along just because these movies are so cool and so technically slick, and that the excitement of science would have made it worthwhile to keep on living. And then I realized I was losing him as the movie got worse and worse, and that by the end of the movie he was back in his grave and I was looking for one for myself. I don't know.
Oh, gosh. This is what happens when your mind wanders when a movie's really dull.
Yeah, I probably should have just gone to see, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle again.
Was that better?
That was way better. I love that movie.
There's images of hockey in several of your films, and I know your father was the treasurer and manager of Canada's national hockey team.
Right.
You described yourself in our first interview as spending most of your childhood in front of the television with your dog. Did you play hockey too?
No, I didn't, and believe me, that was a source of unbelievable shame. Growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, father featured frequently in the city's newspaper, talking about Canada's national hockey team and not being able to skate. I don't know. I just spent too much time in front of the TV. Even my dog was stupid and a very not even paper trained or anything. It was we were both very underachieving organisms. And I finally couldn't stand the shame anymore. I bought a pair of skates when I was about 18. And just went out after dark and taught myself how to skate, and then just fell in love with it, became obsessed with it, dropped out of university and just spent all my time playing hockey with 12-year-olds and until I was good enough to join a team. And I still have that kind of learned late skating style. I skate too straight up and down, and people know I was a late comer to the game, but it's just every stride I take on the ice feels like I'm undoing the shame of my childhood, and I'm not quite done yet. I'm still playing. I'm 48 years old now, and I still play, and I'm not kidding. Every stride I take feels like I'm repairing damage.
Too bad your dog didn't live long enough to undo his reputation.
My dog lived a pure life, underachieving to the end. It didn't even get out of bed to die. Died on my feet while I was sleeping.
Well, Guy Madden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Terry.
Guy Madden speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. His film, The Saddest Music in the World, has just been released on DVD.